Farm.
Hostile Piccadilly Circus. Hostile. This is Piccadilly Circus in the heart of London. It would be difficult to imagine a more hostile place for a plant. Piccadilly Circus, hostile. And yet, even here, Piccadilly Circus, hostile. Piccadilly Circus, hostile.
One and two and three and four.
This week's episode of the Plants of People 2 podcast is brought to you by the Neverwinter Foundation. Snow ruins everything, doesn't it? It makes driving nuts. It's cold. Ice forms on your beard. It's cold. There's no flowering plants. Winter sports are annoyingly just redundant versions of summer sports, i.e. ice fishing. Did we mention it's cold? Here at the Foundation we understand the need for the winter ecologically, we just don't really enjoy it. If you'd like to make a donation to the Neverwinter Foundation, send your hand warmers and beanies to 112,233 Never Ever Drive, San Mateo, California 94010.
One, and two, and three, and four.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Plants of People 2 podcast. Episode 5 of Season 2. I'm going to start off with a little contest. So the prize will be one of each of the new stickers that were recently made. One's a bumper sticker that says Plants of People 2. The other one's a circle, 3-inch circle sticker with an Impatience Compensis in it, and it says Plants for People 2 at the top, and then at the bottom it says Be Rad and Plant Native. The first person to send me the correct answer for the name of this show, and I'm just going to play the intro song, the first person to send me the correct answer will, free of charge, I'll ship it out in the mail, just send me your address, 2 stickers. Here it is. So hopefully someone out there remembers that show. I remember that show growing up, sort of spending weekends and like weeks during the summer in Maine at a cabin watching that show, and a lot of Fawlty Towers, if you know John Cleese and his work before Monty Python. Those are pretty funny. And then a lot of like black and white VHS Alfred Hitchcock movies, like Rear Window and Strangers on a Train is another one that I watched a lot. So that was that theme song for that show just like puts me in that like room in Maine at night. Because that was the only thing that was on PBS. The only thing you could get on television a lot of the times was Maine Public Broadcasting. You know, PBS, and everything was over, you know, the waves. So you just had whatever you could get in reception. And it was usually stuff like that, which, you know, is amazing compared to what we have on television these days. So I hope somebody wins that prize. I think this is a cool little contest to run at the beginning of the episode. And that's in line with David Attenborough, all mashed up at the beginning of the intro. That was a little, I really like his voice, and I'm sure that's a reason why he's famous, but yeah, he has an interesting cadence in how he talks. So I was going to talk a little bit today about some seed experiments I have going on. Right now is, you know, the perfect time. If you're in New England area, you know, sowing outside in the middle of winter, I guess you could. A lot of the seeds around here are going to have at least, you know, a 60 or a 90 day cold stratification period. And that can be accomplished just by putting the seeds in. I put them in like regular plug trays, fill them up with a lot of perlite and some compost mix, some like dirt that I have out here. Some other things, if they're a little more, they need to be planted in a little more like gravelly soil. I bought some bonsai mix I'm going to use and try that. But so in regular plug trays, and then I just leave them outside all winter. And, you know, if you think about it, a lot of these species I'm going to talk about, there's not too much information out there about their germination. A lot of these seeds haven't been, you know, studied the same way that an agricultural crop would have been studied. And so we may or may not know very much about the seed germination requirements of these species. So it's interesting to do some trial and error and see what happens and see what you get and see what works. And some species are probably going to be easier than others, and some species might not germinate at all, or maybe they germinate 2 or 3 years in. So all of this stuff is good to like keep notes on, share your information with other people. I noticed I bought seeds from Prairie Moon not too long ago of the orange fruited horse gentian. And I did a few experiments with those. I used gibberellic acid scarification. So I like sandpapered a little edge down just to like get some moisture into the embryo in there. And I didn't have any germination this past spring, summer, fall with those. And I wonder if, you know, like I talked about on probably the last episode, but planting fresh seeds, I don't have the seed packet for those anymore. But I wonder when those were harvested, because it's an oddball species to try to grow and to try to, you know, get seeds for. So I can't imagine there's a ton of people out there getting seeds. So they probably had a lot of them that were left over, and I got a batch that was maybe a couple years old. So I'm hoping that the seeds that were donated to me are good, and the freshness of them gives them a little bit of an advantage, and I have that species next spring coming up. But so now is a great time to take your wildflower seeds and do what I'm doing, planting them in seed plug trays or like little pots outside. And I keep everything labeled because I'm really interested, and I've like planted anything that was like a decent sized seed, I put in its own little plug. And then some of the other stuff that's more dusty, like spiranthes or any of the lobelias, have really small seeds. I'm trying to think what else there was. Any of the grasses, unless they had a decent sized seed. There's some Glyceria, which is the rattlesnake manna grass. Glyceria canadensis. It's really cool looking. It's really tall. Probably about the size, you know, up to your chest maybe. Wetland plant. But it has these little rattlesnake tail looking fruits on it. And the seeds there weren't a ton of seeds in there. And there's a lot of like chaff for what's around the seed. So you kind of have to look for them. So those, you know, those little ones, I kind of make a couple seed trays of, you know, 8 or 16 plugs, and then I'll just like sprinkle it over the top. And, you know, ideally that's because it's too hard to count out a single seed, or, you know, we want to get as much germination as possible. And if any of those germinate well, then I'll transplant them into something bigger with sort of minimal disturbance to the roots. And then maybe if they're bigger than that, I'll spread them out a little bit. And some plants might not like that. So, you know, there'll be the lobelias, I doubt have a problem with getting split up like that. They seem pretty hardy. But the ones that I'm sort of going to be experimenting with are Spiranthes is the first one, an orchid species. Spiranthes incurva, I found some plants of. And there are Spiranthes species naturally occurring sort of around my area where I'm going to be planting them. So I'm positive that they will do well here based on the habitat. Spiranthes are notoriously difficult genus to ID unless they're in flower. And even if they're in flower, the differences in them are very small. The one species that I've probably found 3 or 4 different species of Spiranthes this past growing season. One of them, I didn't know it at the time when I found it, but it was an uncommon one in Vermont, and I was actually down in like the Manchester area. And this, the name on this one is really hard to say. It's Spiranthes ochroleuca, O-C-H-R-O-L-E-U-C-A, yellow lady's tresses. This one happens to be fairly easy to tell from the other ones because it has a yellow, sort of a yellow labellum inside, or yellow throat. And it is uncommon in Vermont, and it's, let's see what the status is. It's of concern in Rhode Island. It looks like it's fairly widespread in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. But these Spiranthes, I usually find them in open, disturbed sites. So, and they don't like, I don't think they like a lot of competition. It's usually, you know, they're only like maybe 6, 7, 8 inches tall, and everything, they're the tallest thing around. So they're usually in like with mosses and along the edges of like places that are getting mowed is usually a good one. Roadsides, ditches, anything that sort of the overhead competition has been taken away. The other species that I found was incurva, and there is some information about that just recently. Incurva was separated into its own species, the Sphinx lady tresses. It was long treated as part of Spiranthes cernua, which is the nodding lady's tresses, and the species complex was reevaluated and Spiranthes incurva reestablished as a separate species in 2017, and it's an ancient natural hybrid of Spiranthes cernua and Spiranthes magna camporum, which is the giant, the Great Plains lady tresses. It's primarily native to the Great Plains, but there are outlying populations in the east areas of former natural grasslands, such as Black Belt prairies of the southeast. It is found in both fens and wet and dry prairies, often in calcareous soil. So, you know, when I was in school, we learned a lot about like population dynamics, what makes a species, you know, when they talk about like a natural, I forget what they call it, but like a, a natural divide where, you know, one species can no longer interact with the other species, and so they eventually evolve into distinct species that can no longer cross pollinate and share genetic material. I wonder, you know, what the, if you could, if anyone's done the research to look at this incurva species and see if they can be crossed back to Magna Camporum or Cernua and see if they can continue to be, you know, if the genetic material can still be shared. It's also interesting that, you know, I wonder what separated these at some point to become their own species, because that the Magna Camporum, let's see if I can look at a range map on that. So this is pretty interesting. The range map, if you just go to, you know, Google and type it in on Bonaps map, it looks like mostly Texas, Montana, Minnesota, Michigan, up through Ontario into Canada. And it leaves out like West Virginia, South Carolina, North Carolina, New Jersey, all of New England, New York. And then some of these other maps, it looks like it lists it as like sort of all of the Northeast and the center part of the United States. But when you look at iNaturalist, all of the species come up as it's actually like the upper part, so like northwestern New York into Ottawa, Toronto, Michigan, Ohio. Yeah, West Virginia is left out. Few in the Appalachians, North Carolina, South Carolina. And I'm not looking at if it's verified or not, but just to get a rough idea. But so it leaves out Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maine, Rhode Island, all of that out of its range. And Pennsylvania, too. It's just interesting that, you know, maybe that plant crossed with the incurva, which is present in Vermont. Maybe that genetic material that it shared allowed it to do better. And yeah, incurva is all over the place. All over New England, all over New York. And Cernua is even more widespread. Yeah, but there's a distinct line with that Magna Camporum in the upper northwestern edge of New York, which is kind of crazy. So the other side of this that I was going to talk about was I found out that, and I don't know why, maybe I was trying to ID one of these Spiranthes species, but I started reading a paper and it said that Spiranthes seeds were one of the species of orchids that didn't need to have an obligate fungi to germinate. And so the you know, crash course on orchid seed germination is they're like dust. They're very small. They don't really have like a food sac along with the seed that like most seeds do, that when we think about like a corn kernel, it has a little bit of food that allows the seed to germinate and then start out on its own. Orchid seeds don't have that. And so they need that fungal relationship early on in order to get enough energy without having any leaves or anything in order to germinate and then eventually grow to support itself through photosynthesis. And then I think it kills the fungal host. But Spiranthes is one of those seeds and orchid species that may not need a specific fungal host in order to germinate. So it would be able to, you know, work with whatever fungal host you would have in your soil. So my plan is with that is to sort of like broadcast spread that seed onto some soil that I have, and in a little bit of a wetter area that's exposed. I've already sort of cut the area I'm going to do this. I have a whole suite of species that I'm sort of going to put in this little area that they'll all like wetter ground. And I'm going to see what comes up. And hopefully I get those spiranthes to germinate. That would be huge. The other one, anecdotally, that doesn't, you know, that has great success and doesn't really need a specific fungal host is the Epipactis helleborine orchid, which is a non-native orchid that is everywhere. And I see it all over the woods. It's kind of impressive that it's spread that far, but it's never in like great quantity and doesn't look like it's taking over for the most part. But it is interesting how those, they must be on, be spread on birds' legs from somewhere, and who knows. But the other seed species that I'm sort of going to be experimenting with that I couldn't find too much information on was Lobelia calmii and Lobelia dortmana. Calmii is Brooks Lobelia or Calms Lobelia, K-A-L-M-S. And the other one is water lobelia, which is an aquatic lobelia species. I've already planted those, and I did that little experiment in a galvanized sort of like planter tray that I had that was maybe 2.5 inches deep, and it's probably maybe like 24 inches by 24 inches. So I filled that with some of the gravel and dirt from where I got the seeds from. I pulled that out of the water. I also took like a gallon of the water from there, and I put that into the galvanized tray along with the gravel and the sand and dirt. And I add a little extra, and then I sort of filled it up with water, and I scattered the seeds on top, and they've all settled to the bottom. There's some leaves in it now. So my plan is to try to mimic nature in that scenario. And because if you look at those water lobelia plants, they're growing out up through the water, so they're fully submerged, and the only thing that comes up above the water is the flower. And those seeds, I was there when they were fruiting, the capsules all turned down, and they dump all their seeds right into the water. So I did see some things when I was like Google searching around, just looking to find how to, if anyone had tried germination of these seeds. And it looks like a lot of people start them in like soil, and I'm just kind of I don't know if that works or not. It didn't seem like they had great success, and it doesn't seem logical to me to do it that way. So I'm going to try it my way first, and if I need to get more seeds and try to get next year, I will. I still have some left over that I might try. I might look it up again and see if it makes sense the second time I read it. But those seeds were very tiny, but you get a lot in a seed head, so it's, you know, in a like a half dollar size amount of seeds is probably tens of thousands of plants. And there were, you know, thousands of plants at this place, so there's a ton of seed hitting that water all the time. Yeah, so that should be an interesting one. The calmii, the Brook Lobelia, found in the same place as that Spiranthes incurva, those also like low competition, and they're very small. So, you know, they probably only get, you know, half or three quarters the size of the Spiranthes species. So the Kalmia is another one that I'm probably going to set up a little plug tray and then put some gravel in there. That and the Spiranthes were both growing in pretty gravelly soil right along the side of a road. So I'm going to plant those in there and see if I can get those to germinate. The spot that I'm thinking about putting these is I have a little spring behind my house that sort of seeps out in the spring. It has been going dry recently. It's probably got a little water in it right now. We've had some rain, but so I'm going to put them in there. Yeah, I'm going to start them in trays first, and then if I get plugs, I'll transplant the plugs out into this little wetter area to sort of give them a little leg up on hopefully surviving. I have a lot of raspberries in that area, so I need to get rid of those, which I'll probably do soon. The third species that I found, this one, I found it when I was doing Collinsonia canadensis research in North Bennington. Sounds right, North Bennington area. I was right behind this guy's goat enclosure, and off in the distance I could sort of see these whitish flowers. I actually thought they were anemone at first, the thimbleweed, but it was the wrong time of the year. Those are a springtime bloomer, and this was probably like late August. And then I thought maybe it was some sort of aster that I had never seen before that was blooming over there. But so I walked over, and it ended up being plant called Fengrass of Parnassus, which is Parnassia glauca. And they sort of have round basal leaves. They're all in the ground. And then it's got the flower stalk that comes up. And they have one flower on them that's white, and it has sort of like intricate green markings all over the petals. And it does look very similar to like what a thimbleweed flower would look like. But they were all over this place, and that was the first time I'd ever seen that plant in the wild. And subsequently, I found that plant in other places around that same time when I was looking for other species. I would run into that plant a lot. And it seems like... So what I did was I reached out to this landowner, and I was like, hey, can I get some of those seeds? Because there was probably 500 plants all growing on this little seepy area behind a goat enclosure. And the soil kind of has like a little organic material on top, moss, and then if you stick your hand down through it, it's got a gravelly bottom, so it's draining really well down into this little brook that runs through there that sort of separates that area from the goat area. And that species likes calcareous soil, so it likes the richer type of soil, and it was growing with tawny cotton grass. And there was a bunch of other cool plants in there. Plus, you had that Collinsonia, so that site was pretty rich to begin with. And so, all of the seed heads, I went out there on the driest day I could find. All of the seed heads point up after they ripen. They're a dehiscing capsule, so dehiscent just means it opens to disperse its seeds when it's ready. So it lets you know it's really easy to pick out, you know, when the seeds are ready, and sort of takes the guessing out of it, because there's no fruit hiding it. It's, you know, the plant is dispersing it like it's ready to go, so they should be good. The seeds look like, light or like darker amber color. It's like almost grade B maple syrup, but, you know, thinned out a little bit. And it's not, they almost look like a reddish color. So they're not, some seeds end up being black when they're ripe. Some seeds end up being, you know, a little bit more on the brown side, or darker brown, some are lighter brown. These like barely look like seeds. So it's going to be interesting to, this is another one, like I'm just going to scatter plant them and see what comes up in the spring. I have a ton of those seeds, so if anyone wants to try that on their own property, let me know. The range on that species, the range on this species is, you know, Maine, Canada, all the way across to the Dakotas, down through Illinois, and then across to Indiana, Ohio, Pennsylvania. So that's about as far south as it goes. There are other species of this further south into the Appalachians. But yeah, this one, really cool looking, you know, pollinator plant for a wetter part of your garden. And there's, it's rare in New Hampshire, but there's no status on it in Vermont. It's pretty common from what I can see after I saw it the first time. I started seeing it everywhere, which is usually how it goes. Five petals. Yeah, really attractive plant. Check that one out on Go Botany or Google. Google it if you can. And oh yeah, I did get some seeds. And just like you all who are buying seeds, I got some seeds from somebody. I think I traded for Lonicera dioica, which I've seen before, but I noticed it this season a little later in the fall, and it didn't have berries on it, so I didn't get seeds off it. And it didn't look like it flowered, but it's a really, you know, I think of this like Lonicera sempervirens as being a native here, but it's really probably more native down south, and we don't really have that growing in the woods, and if we do, it's rare. But this Lonicera dioica, to me, sort of fills that, you know, vining honeysuckle, you know, area, niche that that sempervirens kind of fills in the horticultural industry, planting gardens, stuff like that. And this one is native. And so these, someone through Instagram, Leo Kenny, sent me these seeds to try to germinate. So I'm going to try to do that, along with, sent me some gentian, I think it's gentian clausa, and oh, the other one was sabbatia, which I have a soft spot in my heart for sabbatia. But then they're also, they're fresh seeds, so they're all from this year, so hopefully I'm gonna have some really good germination and some really good plants, really good native plants next spring. And if I get a bunch of stuff, like I'm gonna have it up available, so anyone who wants that stuff or didn't want to go through the experiment of germination, I should have it available. As well as, here's a plug for Bunker Farm Native Plants. Follow them on Instagram. I just gave them a bunch of seeds for this season from, it was like 47 species of native plants to try to grow. So we're sort of, I'm growing from that same seed batch. So hopefully all those seeds are good and they have a good season with germination. So that'll be a cool another place you can pick up local ecotype native plants if you're from the New England area in New York. The next thing I was going to talk about was patch cuts versus clear cuts. I know that we've had, I've had a few people recently just sort of ask questions about patch cuts, and they've used terminology like, you know, oh, that was a clear cut. And I just want to clarify a few things about forestry in general. You know, clear cut really means like, you know, a forest is getting cut down and it's never going to be a forest again. And so in New England, you have, you know, a lot of our area is forested. And so, you know, when those places get cut, and in the forestry world, we call them an early successional patch cut, all the trees are getting cut down in a 2 to 20, 30, 40 acre patch cut. And a lot of times they are on the smaller side. But there are benefits to having them be bigger as well, and we'll talk about that. But a clear cut is something that's never going to be a forest again. So think about a parking lot or a housing development or a condo, you know, a group of condos that all of that forest is cut down, lawn is put in, roads are put in, houses are put in, a pool is put in, and that will never be a forest again. So that's completely changing that habitat type. Not to mention any wetlands that were there that were, you know, serving a really important purpose. All of the fungi and insects and everything in the soil covered in concrete. So that's a clear cut. The other thing that would happen there, a clear cut would fall into the category of, is agricultural land. So the rainforest clear cutting issue is they're cutting down really biodiverse rainforests for agricultural land where they're going to grow, you know, palm trees for red palm oil or whatever, or sugar cane or something that, or soybeans, something that's going to be some sort of agricultural crop that they can make money off of. So that land will also never be a forest again, serving the same ecological purpose that it was in the beginning. So that's clear cuts. Patch cuts are different in that, yes, you are cutting down, removing the vertical trees in that area, but just because you're doing that, the root systems are still intact. You're taking off the wood, changing the immediate you know, inputs into that area, sunlight, resources. And so in a lot of these places, the places where you choose to put a patch cut is really important, because over the past 100, 200 years, the logging that's happened and the misforest management, sort of going in and high grading, taking only the biggest trees and the best trees and sort of leaving all the crap and not cutting it down, has actually been caused a problem, because now those little holes that were open in the forest where one tree was taken out, really the only species that can survive there is the beech tree. And so beech whips will sprout off the main trunk of a beech tree, which the majority of our beech trees here have beech bark disease. So they're kind of struggling anyway, and they sort of react by sprouting in the understory of these moderately shady, not sunny enough areas, and they can tolerate shade for a long time. And so they decrease the biodiversity in your forest. And so if you have a whole, you know, let's just say it's 10 acres. If you have 10 acres of mismanaged forest where you have small beech whips everywhere that aren't ever going to really be a structural component of the forest, and, you know, let's throw some other things in there. Maybe there's a few really nice trees, like a nice oak tree. It doesn't have to be straight nice. It can just be producing, you know, mast nice, M-A-S-T, you know, or maybe it is a really nice tree, or maybe it's super big and old and you want to leave that one. You can have a patch cut with a few trees left in it, and that's, it will do the same thing as a fully cut patch cut. But if it was all sort of this diseased beech and old bully pines and malformed really stunted trees in the understory. The way that you can sort of mix that up, you choose that spot, those 10 acres that really aren't serving any sort of ecological niche, and you slick it off, take all the trees down. You can leave them all there. All of that stuff is going to be organic material that will rot, that will serve to be amphibian habitat, insect habitat, fungi habitat, all of those rotting logs on the forest floor. And with the increase of light and the little bit of disturbance that will happen with, you know, all the trees that are falling down, you will create more biodiversity than was present in that location prior to the work. So now what you've done is you've taken a forest that may have been of lesser ecological value, taken that off, and now what will happen is you'll have different tree species germinate, different herbaceous plants germinate in the soil. You're probably also going to get invasive plants germinating in the soil. You may not, but likely there are invasive plants already present. And what this does is, with the increase in your plant biodiversity, your small plants in the understory, you're going to have different species of birds come by, different species of wildlife, different species of insects, and they're all going to, you know, up the food chain, attract other species of wildlife. And so you're going to increase the biodiversity of your property. And, you know, if you zoom out on your property and you see that all around you is forest, you know, a patch cut of any size, you know, usually 2 acres is a minimum, and then any size above that, you're going to be increasing the biodiversity of your property and increasing the habitat value of all the other properties around you. You know, you think about a bird species that was living, you know, in your forest. It may be nesting there and it uses that forest to raise its young, but it has to go to a meadow to feed that's, half a mile away. If you put that sort of habitat in the middle of the woods, now that habitat value of where that bird is nesting is greater because it doesn't have to use so much energy to go half a mile away. It can go right through the woods into your meadow and feed, or your patch cut, and feed on insects and everything that it needs there. So I'd really like to start reshaping, you know, our ideas of what, you know, forest management looks like, at least in Vermont, and, you know, it's applicable to other places as well. But having the idea that, you know, we sort of need that mosaic, patchy habitat differentiation across our landscape, and the idea that, like, the forest should never be touched or nothing should ever be done, can apply to certain areas, but it shouldn't be a blanket statement across the entire state, because we need that diversity in order to keep and attract and maintain the species that we have present in our state now. So if you're thinking about doing a patch cut, or if you're not thinking about it and I've changed your mind, we can, you know, sort of stop using that clear cut, or have that apply only to certain areas where those trees are never going to grow again, and start using the term patch cut to really signify that early successional habitat creation that we want to do in select areas where it makes sense to have those, you know, to sort of start over in a way. So the last thing I want to talk about this week is herbariums, and I'm still trying to get somebody on to talk about species and sort of how we determine if a species is a native population or a non-native population, even if that species might be native to that area, is that plant an introduced garden escapee. So I was doing a little research online, and I was looking into some herbariums, and there's actually a bunch of digitalized herbarium samples, which is kind of an amazing thing to be able to do in this day and age. You know, if there's a positive thing about technology, it's definitely that you can go on and search all of these records for basically, you know, all kinds of stuff. This particular one is through the University of Vermont, the Natural History Museum, and it's called Pringle. It's called the Pringle Herbarium, and it has, so there's the Consortium of Northeastern Herbaria, North American Network of Small Herbaria, Consortium of North American Bryophyte Herbaria, Mycology Collections, a bunch of stuff in here. And so I think I went into the Consortium Northeastern Herbaria, and you can sort of go through, you can do a text-based search or a map-based search. You can search a ton of different herbariums across, looks like New England, Nantucket, University of Maine, University of Massachusetts Amherst, Rhode Island, Vermont, Vassar College, Western Connecticut State University, Westfield, Yale. And so you can go in and look at these specimens, and what they've done is they've, you can search it by scientific name. So I forget what I was looking for, but I ended up typing in just my town, Wardsboro, Vermont, and I wanted to see what species had been found around me, or if there was anything that was from Wardsboro that I could sort of learn about. And the interesting thing that came up was Gentianopsis crinata is not far from me, which I was surprised to see. And I mean, that one was found in 1902, which is a long time ago, but that gives me kind of a interesting thing to go look at. If you guys haven't seen that one, you should look that one up. It's fringe gentian. And there was another species, I'm trying to find it. Oh, Platanthera grandiflora. A possible Cellini population that it says it's a blank import. So that's an interesting, because there are no native Cellinis in New England, and there are, but they're historical, so nobody would have found them. But so this is a really cool tool, you know, for anyone who wants to sort of see what the populations of plants were around them, you know, 100 years ago or more than that, or less than that, you know, 50 years ago. There's all sorts of dates on these herbarium samples. But then it leads to the question, like, you know, I'm searching for my, you know, the town that I'm living in, but a lot of what I'm seeing, there are some interesting species, like that Parnassia glauca is from, you know, found in South Wardsboro, where I live, and like, I've never seen that plant. Like, I saw that for the first time, like I said earlier in the episode, you know, down in North Bennington. So that's an interesting little piece of information. Like, I could potentially find that somewhere around me now, but that record's from 1902, so August 28th, 1902. Oh, the other one, Platanthera orbiculata. So that's another Platanthera species that's supposedly around here somewhere. you know, there's a lot of information, a lot of data held in all these documents, because you can see when they were flowering. They're not very specific. Like, I wouldn't be able to go out and actually find these plants with any sort of accuracy, because the coordinates are all changed. So it's not like, it tells you a location of what town it is, what county, and then it just gives you coordinates for the town. So you can look at the herbarium record and see if there's any details in there about where they found it, and you might be able to go see if it's still there. But this gives you information about flowering time and maybe, you know, possibly how some things have changed. The other thing that this makes me sort of question is, you know, there's a lot of species that aren't represented in here from Wardsboro that, you know, I would say occur here. And if you were just using these herbarium samples to put together, you know, a picture of what plants are in this area, there would be huge gaps in that. So again, back to that, you know, is this species a garden escapee? Is it, you know, truly a native population of this plant? If we are basing a lot of our information off of herbarium records, you know, there's a ton of holes in them. And, you know, the herbarium sort of things that we're doing now, the digital herbariums that we're creating through iNaturalist and whatever other, you know, apps are out there to sort of capture photos of plants and record where they are, that's probably going to give us, because there's so many people doing this now, that, you know, when I look at those things, that gives me a more accurate depiction, I think, of, you know, where these plants are occurring and where people are actually seeing them. Because it's so easy to, you know, make an herbarium record, quote unquote, without actually putting the plant in there. But like I've said in other episodes, if you take really good pictures, like those four or five pictures that make sense of the characteristics of that plant, its habitat, the flower, the vegetative leaves, and anything else that looks out of the ordinary, also putting something in there for scale, you know, or the better thing is like a ruler to show how big things are. Those records are going to be, in my mind, much more valuable than this stuff. Although these digital historical records are super cool to look at. And, you know, from just looking at my town in this database, you know, there's three species that I'm really interested to find here if I can. And so I'm going to keep my eyes open for them and hopefully come across them, you know, out in the wild someday. And you have to be careful because some of these are mislabeled too, and they're not necessarily in order. So you have to sort of read into everything, but it's a good wintertime project as we come into that non-flowering time of year. Today and yesterday and tomorrow are going to be some of the best fall days probably we'll have. So, you know, get outside and enjoy that as much as you can, because this weather isn't going to last long. We might even get snow, I've heard, pretty soon here. So I'm not looking forward to that. Again, if you guys have any questions, you can feel free to reach out to me at plantsorpeopletopodcast@gmail.com. I'm on Instagram at plants.r.people.2. I have Plants or People 2 stickers available. They're $5 each that I'll get them shipped to you. If you want to just send me a DM or an email, I can send you my Venmo information, and I'll get those out to you as soon as I can. I also do have some seeds left, although I am getting ready to plant them probably in the next couple days. Everything I have left, I'm going to put in seed trays and leave them outside over the winter and hopefully have some seedlings in the spring to let you guys know about and yeah, get out into the soil. So hope you guys are doing good. get in touch, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.